Hi, Mark Thompson here. What you've downloaded is an episode of Tilt at the Mill, which is a podcast that I do usually fortnightly, but this was a special episode where I interviewed four of the Police and Crime Commissioner candidates for Devon and Cornwall. The station that we broadcast from is based in Newton Abbot in Devon, so we thought it would be a good opportunity to get some of the candidates together. Unfortunately, there were some technical problems. So we've still released the podcast, but we had to remove the first section. So the introduction of the candidates and the first few minutes of the debate is missing. And then as the episode goes on, there were still some ongoing technical issues with the microphones and I think the levels not being quite right. They get better as it goes on. About halfway through, things improve, but just be aware you will hear breathing and so forth on the microphones, and I apologise for that. But it is a very good debate, and I think that the candidates not only answered questions to do with the local area, but also on national issues as well. So even if you don't live in Devon and Cornwall, I think it's still worth a listen, and quite a lot of the questions about the Police and Crime Commissioners would apply nationally anyway. So I hope you enjoy it. Just so you're aware, the candidates that were on the panel were Gareth Derrick, who's the Labour candidate, Alison Hernandez, who's the Conservative candidate, Richard Younger-Ross, who's the Lib Dem candidate, and Jonathan Smith, who's the UKIP candidate.
Mark Thompson on Tilt at the Mill.
Looking at current affairs and culture from a different angle.
Contact Mark now. Tweet at Tilt UK.
Okay, I want to ask a question now that is actually related to something that you would have power to do, because you wouldn't have power to change the rules about how PCCs are selected in the first place. But I don't know if you remember Anne Barnes. She's the outgoing commissioner for Kent, and she appointed a girl, I think she was 17 years old, called Paris Brown as her youth commissioner. And it ended with Paris being forced to resign because of tweets she'd made before she was appointed to the role. It's an homophobia. I mean, she was just a child when she'd done these tweets. And I think there's a concern that that episode will stop future PCCs, one of whom may be in this room, from thinking outside of the box. So what will you do that you consider to be innovative? Can we start with you, Jonathan?
What I do innovative? I think we need to advertise the role across the whole sphere of our society. Get people interested. If you do disbar people because they've done something on Twitter or on Facebook, you could be taking away a lot of potentially good candidates, because we know people get carried away on Facebook, they get caught up in the moment, and there are a lot of people that actually think that using Facebook they're immune from any kind of prosecution anyway. It's as if it's not real, it's surreal, it's just something written down, it's not an important point. And I think it's just judging in what context those actual comments were made, but I think we're being very insular in opening up to everybody and then looking at each individual case on its own merit.
What do you think?
Well, I have to say that when that first came up, the youth commissioner thing, I thought it was quite a good idea potentially, and we're all talking about trying to engage with the public better, and that's one way to do it, because, you know, there needs to be some better connection with the youth today. So it wasn't a bad idea in principle at the time. It obviously went very badly wrong and not to be repeated. Where I would go with innovation, I don't know. I'm probably more boring in my innovation, but I want to do something like members of the public have relationships with many different people they work with. I would like to set the levels of service that people can expect, so they can call me to account on me not meeting, on the police, I should say, not meeting the standards that we're setting for ourselves.
What do you think, Alison?
Well, I'm really into innovation, and I think Devon and Cornwall Police want to be the most innovative force that they can be, actually. They're really up for it. I certainly think there's nothing wrong with involving young people. Everybody, you have to, like you say, Jonathan, have a broad spectrum of people involved in whatever that we get in, that we start to do. But the innovative thing that I really want to do is develop cybercrime cafes. So I used to run a social media cafe every month in Torbay with specialists who would help people learn how to get online and use the different platforms. I want to do cybersecurity ones. I want to help educate people how to be safe online, and I want the community to help run those in lots of different cafes throughout Devon and Cornwall, and educate young people to be protected online, and to help businesses as well, particularly because they're telling me cybercrime is their number one issue.
Okay, Richard?
I'm all for innovation. I do think there's a lot of the basics which you need to get right, which are not right at the moment. And some of those are fixing things about how we deal with domestic violence and rape, how we deal with cybercrime, what we deal with in terms of Neighbourhood Watch, which desperately needs to be fixed because that's falling apart at the moment. In innovation, I actually think going back to the youth, you're saying that it's, you know, oh, it's been done, we can't do it again because it went wrong. I think you can give it another go. But you do have to be careful of the tweets. And if you look at what's happened in Parliament in the last couple of weeks, where there were anti-Semitic tweets, then people do have to be careful what they say.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you should say that, because my follow-up question to this was going to be, I mean, Paris was effectively thrown to the wolves after what happened, in the wolves of the media, as far as I can tell. So as a follow-up question, I mean, what would you do to protect any appointees that you make if a scandal blows up around them?
I think you have to stand by them if they're a young person. They have to be able to accept what they have done. But what you don't do is allow the Fleet Street, the tabloids, to go banging on their door and shouting at them. And you have to stand up and say, hold on, let's give her a bit of space. No, or him, I'm going to stand by them. They are going to carry on. They accept what they have done is wrong. And you work your way through it.
The main thing... Go on, Gareth.
For a moment, yeah, Richard, thanks. I mean, I talked about innovation that I might come up with, but I'm not the one that's going to do all the innovating. What I want to do in my role is actually innovate with other people, work with other people, the voluntary sector, the charity sector, that kind of thing. Let the innovation come from those people. That's where I think we should get a lot of creativity.
And that follows on nicely what Alison said about your cyber cafes and your community involvement. I think the community themselves have absolved themselves from too much of their own responsibility. And I think it's time for them to start stepping forward and actually caring for their own community. So these cyber cafes won't necessarily be run by agencies, it'll be run by the communities themselves. It doesn't have to be a cafe. You can do it with neighbours, you can do it in church halls, you can all do it together to actually work together to make your community safer, to work with the police. Now, in Newquay, they've got a system called StreetNet. Now, StreetNet is a group of people who all have an internet access with emails, and they have targeted emails. So many houses in a street, if somebody sees something wrong or there's some information they need to pass the police, they'll hit that StreetNet, it'll hit all those, and it cascades it. But it's also where the police get information to the community, so that an offence occurred somewhere, or a robbery or a burglary, they'll be informed straight away rather than being blind to what's going on in their community. So there are innovative things we can use.
Can I just go back to the accountability question for accountability? That's exactly what I would do if I would take the hit of somebody that was within my sphere of I had decided to appoint or I had decided to have part of my team. I will take the hit. That is what we are here for.
You wouldn't fire them.
I don't think I would fire someone on the basis of a tweet.
Do you have fired Paris Bradley with the circumstances?
Do you know what the main issue with these are? Is actually you need to know the person that you're actually recruiting in the first place. And as with all types of business, it's how you recruit them that actually makes a difference. So I would make sure that I would know them.
Do her due diligence properly, because she could have...
I don't think she did. You do need to be doing that.
And a lot of employers now do go back and look at Facebook and do look at Twitter.
It's very easy to do these days, isn't it? Yeah.
I tell you what, I'm very grateful that Facebook and Twitter didn't exist without
me. I know.
Alison, we're going to move on to... we're going to do this for each of the candidates now, but Alison's going to go first, and that is that I've asked all the candidates to submit questions for the other candidates. Now, Alison has just selected one question.
Yeah.
And she's going to ask it to all three of the candidates.
So my question is, because you're more likely to be a victim of crime online than you are in the streets where you live, what experience do you have around this arena, or what ideas do you have to actually tackle it?
Should we start with Jonathan?
Victims online. I think it's all to do with education, and people need to be educated as to how vulnerable they can be online and the impact that the way they behave online actually causes problems to other people. I don't think people actually understand how deeply hurtful some comments on Facebook, etc. could be. Now, I'm not on Facebook. I don't tweet because of my background. I know the misery is what I was looking for, the misery that these systems can cause to people. And sometimes that misery isn't necessarily deliberate. It's just an oversight. And I think people need to understand that they're as liable to face prosecution and as liable to be dealt with for dealing with things on Facebook as they are in life in law. Mm. I don't think they do. Mm. I think people understand that there's the same set of rules and laws to actually use Facebook. If I had my way, I'd shut Facebook down. It's costing the police force millions and millions and millions of pounds. Now, you can turn Facebook off. You can turn Twitter off. The little elderly lady living down in St Ives who's had her back door kicked in and had her house burgled, she can never turn that off. She can't stop her back door being kicked in. And I think we need to focus as much, if not more, on how real crime affects people. Because it seems we've taken our eye off the real crime,
because of the problem with Facebook. And I do wonder sometimes, one last point, whether or not the police are spending a lot of time dealing with Facebook and Twitter because you've got a victim and you've got a culprit.
But isn't,
so you've got a detected crime.
Isn't what you just said, though, Jonathan, basically blaming the media? You know, whatever medium you have, you know, people are going to abuse it, aren't they? You know, people abuse the phone system, people abuse the postal system. Whatever system you have, you can't turn time back, you can't turn Facebook off. Even if you somehow were able to turn Facebook off, another Facebook would bring
pop up
5 minutes
later. I accept that's
not the real world, is it?
No, I accept that. But it is to do with people understanding the impact of using that medium. And I'm sure most people don't.
OK. Richard, same question.
As a Member of Parliament, as a councillor, it's an issue that does come up, and I've had to deal with that and deal with bullying on Facebook and try to help someone with that and try to deal with some of the issues of people who've been defrauded online. Indeed, there was something in my email box today which was someone saying, "We wish to make a donation to you." And of course, during the election, everyone thinks, "Oh, yes, we all like a donation to our campaign, don't we?" And this wasn't a donation to the campaign, this was a scam. Facebook have just announced record profits because of people advertising. It's probably what we're all doing to boost our campaigns on Facebook. However, that said, if they're making record profits, there's probably a little bit more they can do to try and stop cybercrime. And we need to work with the agencies, whether it's Google and Facebook and the others, to try to ensure that they have everything in place to catch up. But there's one scam that's been going on, and that's to do with tax discs. Tax discs are being paid for, accounts are being hacked, details taken. The police are being told that this has happened. The culprits are getting the money back because it's done on a credit card, but the police aren't finding the drivers and prosecuting them, although they clearly have an address and a license plate number.
Okay, same question to Gareth.
Yes, well, thanks. Well, Jonathan said quite a bit about the victim side of cybercrime, and he said some sensible stuff then. I agree with that, and I've got personal experiences which back that up. It can be very, very damaging. But actually, we've got to look at the other side of it as well. It's not just about working with agencies. It's actually about building the capabilities within the police of Devon and Cornwall to deal with this crime. So I see there's going to have to be a kind of shift in the workforce makeup into the longer term, where we do bring many, many more civilian experts on dealing with this kind of crime into the force, and that will be an innovation.
Alison, you asked the question. Do you think they've answered it?
I think they've done a fair job. I think they have an understanding of the seriousness of it. And what I would say is that the, I mean, when I run the social media cafes, I had a 15-year-old student who was helping me, and she was an expert in how to set up accounts. And she actually did a talk about cybercrime, cyberbullying, and how to protect yourself online. Young people are going to help us with this to actually make it improve. So I think I just wanted to add that on the end, really.
Okay. I want to move on to talk about Hillsborough. Obviously, the inquiry's been in the news this week. This is a fairly lengthy question, but bear with me, because I'll ask each of you in turn to respond. There's a few questions.
Do we get lengthy answers?
You will be allowed lengthy answers for this one, Richard, yes. So, first of all, generally, what are your views on what happened, and what would you do to increase transparency in the police force, which does seem to have been a problem in this case, and sadly there have been plenty of other examples of that as well over the years. Do you think there should be prosecutions as a result of the findings of the inquest of senior officers? And the Chief Constable of South Yorkshire has been suspended by its PCC, and it looks like he may ultimately be forced to resign. And there's been a lot of media and political pressure for him to do so. Now, obviously, this is a unique case, but as the ability to hire and fire the Chief Constable is one of the gravest responsibilities you have as PCC, generally, what criteria would you use to make that sort of decision? So I'm not talking specifically about Hillsborough, I'm talking about generally, what would the threshold be for you to be considering firing the Chief Constable, which is like kind of the nuclear option? We'll start with Alison.
Firstly, the Hillsborough thing's just so, so sad. It's taken so long to get to this point for the families. It feels sad to be almost benefiting as a Police and Crime Commissioner election on the back of it, to be able to bring into focus what the value of a Police and Crime Commissioner could bring to a force that has done some bad things. I think for me, in terms of this, I mean, there are ethical standards that the police force, they do work by, they do have, and you can hold them to account for that. But I think one of the main things that will actually help here, there's two things. One is, you as a Police and Crime Commissioner and your office has to be accessible accessible, approachable, and able to be able for people to want to come and actually talk with you and share with you concerns that they may have. So the first thing is to make your office accessible and approachable. And one of the ways that I'm looking to do that is to spread the team out across the patch and be closer to the communities that I'm serving if I'm elected. So the bit for me is about that accessibility and approachability. The second is to have a relationship with the chief constable that is constructive, a critical friend, and not, you know, you will do this, Mr. Chief Constable. It needs to be.
No, elected, you won't have the power to tell him or her.
No. But you'll be surprised around the country, police and crime commissioners and their attitudes. They haven't all been, you know, friendly working as a team. And I come with a team approach to my leadership. I want to work with the Chief Constable because I want, if something like this was to happen within Devon and Cornwall, I would want him to not be afraid to tell me something's gone wrong, rather than feel the need because of fear to cover it up or anything like that. So that this is about leadership style for me. It totally is about leadership style and having then my office available to be able to be accessible and approachable.
Okay, Jonathan.
What happened at Hillsborough was a terrible tragedy. There were a lot of factors that caused it. It was an unfit ground, a ground without a safety certificate, a ground not fit to carry many fans, turnstiles that weren't big enough. But it was also exacerbated by senior officers who were out of their depth. David Duckenfield, as I understand it, hadn't carried out a major football match or a major job in his career. It was a tick in the box for his CV. Now, if that happened, well, when that happened, it was bad enough, the fact that we had the Hillsborough disaster. What was far, far worse was the future cover-up, the collusion, the corruption, to dispel the blame from the police to the fans, which was unfair, because the fans have a right to go to this sort of match to be protected by the police, because the police are there to protect life and property, and they failed to do so. In fact, they caused, in a big way, the actual offence itself. If it happened again, I would ensure that the Chief Constable and the force actually openly and transparently investigated it. In fact, you might even suggest that another force should be brought in straight away to deal with it, rather than a force with profile, which will happen now anyway. Prosecutions, we've still got the Operation Resolve going, which is the police probe into the actual problems, and we've got an IPCC investigation going on about the cover-up and what happened subsequently. Now, both of those are due to end in about December, January, and then 3 to 6 months after that, we should get a decision from the Crown Prosecution Service, the DPP, when the prosecution should be brought. And if it is found that the senior officers, and we're talking mainly senior officers, the official police officers on the ground, the police constables, the sergeants, were in an untenable situation. They wanted to help, but they were ordered to stay. And you get the stage of then, if you're told to do something by a senior officer, you obey the order, because they didn't necessarily know what was happening in that actual Billingsgate end. But the management did, but they didn't tell the police. So the senior officers are the ones that colluded, or corrupt, that caused the problems, hid it all away, and didn't actually behave honestly and openly. So they've undermined the trust from the police force. Mr. Crompton, I think, had it not been for this inquest, would have been removed from his post considerably earlier, because he'd been writing emails about the Hillsborough disaster, where he referred to the family's version of events was becoming so the norm that they would just reduce the police story to roadkill. He was the chief constable for the Rotherham child sex exploitation problems, and he was also the chief constable for the Cliff Richard debacle as well. So all those things there at that point were saying this man is incompetent and shouldn't be imposed. But Dr. Billings couldn't remove him because it would have had an unfair knock on to the actual
thing. That's an example of where a chief constable has been removed. But what would be your general approach? What kind of criteria would you be looking at?
If the chief was consistently not delivering efficiency, not delivering the points of the action plan, of the police and crime plan, if he was not engaging, if he was obstructive, corrupt, whatever, the first thing I'd want to do is to identify why, work with him, encourage him to actually step up to the mark and do his job. Because I think to a certain degree, if a police and crime commissioner ends up in a position where he has to remove the chief constable, then perhaps the police and crime commissioner has to look back
over a period of time and say, how did we get here?
Okay, so it sounds like for you the threshold is pretty high. It's going to be pretty unlikely if you're elected during your tenure you would...
It depends on... I mean, something like Hillsborough, something like Rotherham... Yeah.
In extremis, but...
If it's something that can't be resolved through... talking or something, but through learning from the mistakes and moving forward. If he's prepared to move forward after making mistakes, and he's prepared, he wants to stand and fight his ground, then that's the time when you say, this isn't going to work, you're not prepared to compromise, you're not prepared to actually learn from mistakes and move forward.
And I wouldn't sack a chief constable for making a mistake if he admitted it and then we worked out what it was that actually went wrong. I would rather them admit it and we work through it than to actually, this is the problem of any sort of cover-up that was going to go on.
Richard Younger Roslick then.
I think there's several aspects to this. First of all, you have a look at what happened after Hillsborough and during the inquest and the inquiries. It is typical of any large organisation coming together to protect its own. You will see that in the Army, you see that in the Navy, and I'm sure Gareth would know. The Army over the killings, the suicides in the barracks in Surrey.
Deep cut.
Exactly the same thing happened. The incident outside Downing Street where the minister was absolutely out of order. How can you use the F word at a police officer and not be sacked? But because all you did or did not call him a prat, you get away with the word.
It's a pleb, actually. I think that was a particularly politically loaded word because of the connotations of the word pleb. I think if it had been prat, it would have been a lot less serious.
Sorry, it was pleb. But the issue was that he used a worse word, a police officer, and got away with it. But some police officers decided to conspire together to try to reinforce. So there was an issue. So the first thing you have to look at if there's an incident is about how you cut through the camaraderie and having an independent voice which is outside of the police actually is very important for that. So people say they don't want necessarily politicians to be commissioners. Actually, in some ways, they might be better at doing the job. Although a constable, I think, don't think necessarily would have the same issue as some others in this context.
You're right there. There's absolutely no love lost between a police constable. No love lost between a police constable and any kind of senior officer whatsoever. The old adage for us used to be, you're going to get your back stabbed in the police station, we'd best get out the front door quick and go and work with the public.
But the other issue is about, you know, how do you control a chief constable? It's about targets. If a chief constable does something wrong, it's investigated by the Independent Police and Crime Authority. If it is not meeting targets, and there are cases where chief constable are not meeting targets, then it is the duty of the Police and Crime Commissioner to take action. And what we have seen around the country is that Police and Crime Commissioners are not taking action when their chief constables are clearly not meeting the targets set for them.
Okay. So, Gareth.
Yes, thanks. Well, a huge amount has been said about the tragedy of the Hillsborough event, and I won't go through that again. I mean, there are two parts to it. One is the event itself, and the second hugely terrible part about it is the cover-up that's gone on for so long. A lot has been said. At the end of the day, it's all about being prepared to cut through the clouds of obscurity that have been sown in this one, and that's where the strength of the Police and Crime Commissioner will come in. He's got to have the guts to demand far more from the senior officers in his team to get to the truth, and he must not accept the kind of platitudes that we've heard and mistruths that have been spread, as in this case. But straight to the fixed question, the main questions, prosecutions. Yes, I would prosecute in this case. I would like to see prosecutions, absolutely. The criteria for getting rid of a chief constable, I think essentially it's to do with gross loss of public confidence. And that may be for various factors, but it could be negligence, for example, and obstruction with regard to carrying out the strategic direction of the PCC. I would be prepared to sack a chief constable, but it would be taken very seriously.
Okay. There is a follow-up question related to this. There's been a lot of talk in the days following the result of the inquiry as to the role that Freemasonry might have played in this. And I'm just interested in your thoughts as to whether maybe you think there should be a separate inquiry into the influence that Freemasonry's had in this case and maybe in other cases, and also whether any of you are actually Freemasons. Gareth?
I'm certainly not a Freemason, and I know very little about the Freemasons, but I was very perturbed when I was doing a bit of my tour around Devon and Cornwall recently to see a police station that I visited had a Freemason's symbol marked on the side of the wall. it wasn't a police station, actually. It was a magistrate's court, I think, or something. But it was close to the criminal justice system. It was an old building. This does worry me. I really am concerned about it. And I would like to think there may be a need for an inquiry into this kind of problem.
Okay, Alison?
Well, I mean, I think the public don't realise that Freemasons are one of the largest charity givers in this country to people.
Are you a member?
I am not a member. I know members of Freemasons, as I'm sure everyone around this table probably do. There's lodges all over the place. I'm a woman and I know, so there you go. I actually can see, I know some of them. So for me, I think there's a misunderstanding about Freemasons. And I think it's used as an excuse, actually, a lot of the time. Because the reality is, the standards in a workplace, you can't cut corners anymore. You have to have an audit trail when you make decisions. And so actually today, I think it would be much, much harder for an influence such as Freemasons to have on an organisation.
I'm concerned, though, that actually, we're not talking about audit trails here. We're talking about funny handshakes and deals made in back rooms where there isn't any scrutiny or accountability.
That's politics. I'll just give you an example. You know, if you but what I'm going to say is that the reality is that when decisions are made, you'll find, and this is people down the pub having a conversation about what they're going to be doing about something that's quite serious. You'll find them having dinner. So, or having lunch somewhere, it's not actually behind, you know, closed doors. It's actually in public places, and this is how conversations happen and change happens.
Ways that collusion happens of the kind that we've seen in the Hillsborough event. I'm not saying it was in any way related to Masonic activities. No idea, but that kind of acceptability of that kind of hidden deal making is the very root of some of these problems we've seen in Hillsborough and many other police corruption cases.
I think the collusion in this instance isn't Freemasonry. I'm a Freemason. I've only been a Freemason for 3 years.
Sorry, sometimes it might not be clear to the listeners. This is Jonathan
yes.
Smith.
Yes, okay. Jonathan Smith, I'm a Freemason. I joined the end of my police service 3 years ago when I moved to Tiverton.
So you weren't a member whilst you were an active police officer?
No, okay. But
were you approached when you were an active police officer?
Yes, okay. But they wanted me to join the emergency services lodge, and I had to work with them. I didn't want to socialise with them as well. It's boring, isn't it? You know? But the collusion in this instance, is, as far as I can make out, isn't Freemasonry, the collusion of senior officers in the ranks. There are many, many, many police constables, sergeants in Freemasonry. They get nothing out of it, apart from camaraderie and social out of work. And as Alison said, they raise a huge amount for charity. All Freemasonry is nowadays, certainly the lodge I'm in and the lodges I'm part of, is a gentleman's dining club. There's no gain from it. I've worked in Avon and Somerset for 30 years, and I've never known a gain of somebody getting an advantage just because they're a Freemason. And I find it quite surprising that the people that are pointing the fingers and saying there is a gain are the people that don't understand it. I think a lot of the time when people see secrets in a society, they think it's a secret society, and they think it's corrupt, and they think they're hiding something. They're not. You know, they have their own clubs and rules. We have the REC club, we have clubs in Piccadilly, we have clubs in London, where they've got their own rules, but not everybody's actually au fait with these rules. So, as a secret society, it isn't. As a collusion to actually influence the police force, certainly at my level, it isn't. And I was point the finger at senior officers and say, that's where your collusion and that's where your problem is, because they're looking at their own little empire rather than the empire of the police force and the public.
I'm not really aware how many senior officers are members of the Masonic Society. So is it endemic within senior police officers?
No, not that I know of. There's a lot of retired senior officers. Whether they're Masons when they're in the police, I don't know.
You have...
Richard Younger Ross.
Richard Younger Ross. I am not a Freemason. I'm a Roman Catholic, so my faith tells me, my church tells me I shouldn't join them. And I wouldn't join them anyway, because I don't believe in joining that sort of a secret society or dining clubs or whatever, which are men only clubs, basically.
Actually, they're not. There are mixed Freemasons, and there are female Mason clubs as well.
That's new, that.
No, it's been going for a number of years now.
So secret, years. No one told me.
So you're going to join us?
No, no thanks, you're right.
I think that bridge is you don't even know the rules.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's making them
up. Well, I suppose it makes wearing the aprons better, right? I think the issues around it is about perception, and that's very important. Public faith in the police is very important. So you need transparency. So you need within the police to be able to have that register of interest, so everyone knows who belongs to what. You do it in councils. If you remember the golf club, whether the rugby club, whether the Masons or whatever, you have to declare it.
I think there might be a large membership at St Melian, actually, from Devon and Cornwall Police. Yeah.
Because you can then begin to put together that's the trail to see whether people are meeting in social circles and then going on and, you know, making backroom deals, inappropriate backroom deals, rather than the friendly discussions that happen and actually keep society by and large ticking over.
Okay. Well, let's move on. We're going to go for another question from a candidate for the other candidates now. So, Jonathan Smith from UKIP, can you ask your question?
All right, you're going to like this.
Go on.
Having no operational or practical policing experience, do you feel you can effectively challenge the Chief Constable, or will he be able to bamboozle you?
Can we go to Richard Younger-Ross first for that?
No. If you're used to scrutinising, then you get used to looking and learning. I was a member of the Armed Forces Parliamentary Scheme. I was a member of the Defence Select Committee. I had to look at foreign policy. I am used to quizzing ministers. You look at your brief, you look at what they should do, and then you have a look at what they've done. I would not be bamboozled. And I would not, and I would just say to anyone, at any point, whether it's my county councillor hat on now or the chief constable at a later date, do not try to bamboozle me, because that is the wrong way to approach it.
Did you have advisors or consultants when you were the MP for these committees?
You do have advisors, but you have your police and crime office. You have advisors and independent advisors there, and you need to make sure the appointments to that do an independent job, as I'm sure they do, to give you that advice.
Okay, Alison Hernandez.
Well, this again is a leadership style for me, right? So one of the things that I've got a track record of is I've helped leaders improve their organisations all throughout the UK, housing associations, particularly the railway industry. And the one thing that you do so that you don't get bamboozled is you always check on the front line how things are working. You always talk to the people who are doing the job. It is the only way to have a check and balance around what is actually happening. You know, some of the things that we might do if we are elected, we will want to see if the change that we are instigating is making an improvement to the front line. So for me, I think the next PCC needs to have a really good relationship with frontline officers.
Okay. Gareth Derrick?
Well, I spent my career being scrutinised by people at every level, and I'm talking about young sailors, young soldiers, who are scrutinising my behaviour. And this is the other side of the coin. And at the same time, I've also been scrutinised myself, and I've been scrutinising myself, other people's performance. And therefore, absolutely no problem from my side. I have the determination and the ability to see through things and hold the police chief constable to account.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, though, Jonathan. I'm asking Jonathan to correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm going to just maybe slightly put the question in a slightly different way.
Okay.
What Jonathan is asking really that because of your lack of experience of policing, that there may be tricks and things that chief constables can do that are outside of your field of experience that mean that you may not even realise that these things have been done. I mean, I'm slightly reminded of, I know it's a satire and a comedy, but Yes Minister, the kind of rings that the civil service used to run around the ministers in, that sort of thing. I think that's what Jonathan's getting at.
My career has been hugely diverse, and I have jumped from one thing to another, ranging from, you know, high level, sort of like ministerial politics in an embassy, right down to very difficult challenges and questions raised over, for example, prison arrangements in Iraq, in the post-conflict situation in Iraq. I have been able to adapt and jump between all of these things, and I do not see this arena, the police, as being something beyond that capability.
There is something that we are being, well, I don't know if we are, but that's a bit of a bamboozle at the moment that's going on, which is police community management officers. It's a new role that the chief constable wants to develop. It was at the police and crime panel recently, and all of the panel was like, what is this role? What is it any different from a normal police officer? Is it a civilian role? How are you going to recruit into them? There's actually, one of the things that I can't stand and is a bugbear of mine is introducing new roles.
What is it?
Exactly. I would say, when you look at the job description, it was on the police and crime panel paperwork. When you look at the job description, is it a crime prevention officer? It's unclear. And things like that. I don't like introducing new things when actually what's really needed is that police officers need to be able to do their job properly and have better...
Do you ever watch the Select Committee in Parliament's work? That's exactly what they do. You take the minister apart... bit by bit, word by word, about what they mean.
Yeah.
Do you know, actually, just to digress slightly from this debate for a second, watching proceedings in Parliament in select committees is one of the most interesting
it
ways
is.
To
it's
understand
the best.
How Parliament works.
It is one of the best parts of Parliament and the most effective and most underrated.
Yeah, it's a shame that more people don't spend half the day watching BBC Parliament, but, you know, it's a niche interest. Okay.
Can I come back at Alison one thing there?
Yeah, sure. How do you feel they've answered your question?
Sorry, Alison, the nail smack bang squarely on the head. It's the interaction with the frontline officers, it's the interaction with the police officers who are trying to do the service at the point of delivery. They know what works, they know what doesn't work. And sometimes we need to innovate, we need to look forward, but sometimes we need to look back and say to these frontline officers, well, what we're doing now isn't working. Why did it work before? What did you do differently then? And that's the actual interaction that you need.
That's true. In 2003, I went out to Iraq with the Armed Forces Parliamentary Scheme. We're in uniform. We're embedded with the troops. We actually talked to the troops. They talked to you face-to-face. Mm. We came back and quizzed ministers. And what we were being told in Iraq by the guys on the ground, and the larger guys and a couple of the ladies on the ground, was very different to what the ministers were saying. Mm. And you were able to use that experience you gained and say, well, actually, Minister, that's not quite what we've been told.
OK. We need to move on. Last time, the PCC elections, the turnout was 15%, which, let's be honest, is derisory. What are you expecting the turnout to be this time, and what do you think it would need to be to justify the mandate you're giving to this, to be honest, very powerful role? And what have you personally done to try and help raise turnout? We'll start with... Jonathan Smith from UKIP.
The turnout last year, as you said, was derisive, 15%. November 2012. And I think it was a shocking turnout.
I mean, for some people, it calls into question the entire mandate.
Yeah, it does. Do people understand it? Do they know about it? Do they care about it? You have to question. But there is actually no constitutional minimum amount of people to give you a mandate to rule.
I mean, I think that's true for pretty much anyone.
It is. It is all of them. So we've got to try and ask why people aren't coming. And I say it's because they don't care.
Well, do you think it would be better this time?
The local elections in Plymouth and Exeter might increase it a little bit. They've forgotten the importance of the Peace and Crime Commission, which I would say is a hugely important and very powerful role. And I think it's too late to try and do it now, but we're all trying to drum up support. I've sent leaflets all over the county. Cost me a fortune. Thousands of pounds. I'm a poor pensioner. I can't afford that. But I'm trying to spread the word that there's an election going on.
It's good to hear you doing your bit for democracy. I mean, obviously, we're at the Music Mill here trying to do the same thing. Mm. I get, you know, more coverage. In fact, it was when I interviewed Alison a few months ago.
That Alison actually suggested that we had a debate here, because I think you thought there were going to be none.
Yeah,
as it is, there've been a few.
At the time that there wouldn't be any at all. I mean, we've had Radio Cornwall one, we've had a Radio Devon one, we've had a University of Plymouth. They've been the big ones that we've had. Thanks for doing one. That's all I can. Well, say. This is much nicer. You know, we all like each other. You're all right.
Yeah. kind of spoils it a bit. I prefer to think that politicians hate each other. Sitting around having a chat and a laugh. Gareth, what do you think?
Well, I'm being a bit more positive, I think, here, because I'm pretty convinced that there will be a significantly higher turnout in certain parts. I mean, I'm talking now about Plymouth and Exeter, and my estimates are that in Exeter, because of the full city council elections going on there, we could see turnouts 35, 40, 50%, which is going to make a significant difference. Well, hang on, and in Plymouth too, I think there will be a much stronger turnout, such as 35%. But it's still going to be very weak around the country. My experience is the same as what we've heard here. But we have all done our bit. I mean, I've been out having public meetings in a lot of places around Devon and Cornwall, and the first thing I have to do, rather than give out any kind of political message, I spent normally at least half the time explaining what the role is to people, and actually they do get it when it's explained to them. It's so sad that there's so little knowledge about there of its value.
Richard Junger-Ross?
Well, Tony Hoggs resigned partly because of the way the government have handled this, the way the government have allowed the European referendum to totally override all publicity. I think he was probably also upset that there's no free post or anything to enable candidates to communicate to every household, that it is purely down to the individual candidates. So the government are playing this really as a, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, we'll get some police and crime commission candidates in, and May, you know, the Home Secretary has said to people, oh, you mustn't have those evil other people, you've got to have Conservatives PCCs, whereas actually you don't need Conservative PCCs, you don't need Labour PCCs, you don't need Lib Dem PCCs, you just need independent PCCs, and I'm sure all of us here would do that if we were selected to that post.
If we edit this, Richard, we can have you saying that there shouldn't be Lib Dem PCCs. You do realise that, don't you?
I agree with that.
There are others that would try to do that, but I know you're a nice person.
Yeah. You only know me for half an hour.
But the issue is, it is going to be a low turnout. And I think what will be the real telling point for this is what the differential is between the turnout for the city elections and the PCC election in Exeter and Plymouth. Mm. If the PCC election vote is significantly lower, then I think that will be an indication that there's a lack of support and lack of understanding. And there are a lot of people who didn't vote last time because they do not agree with the post. They see it as a waste of money. And I agree with them.
Okay, you know, sorry, Gareth, I'll just let Alison answer this question first.
So for me, firstly, it's the current incumbent's role, the Police and Crime Commissioner, whoever is elected in the job at the moment, it is their job to promote what a Police and Crime Commissioner does, what they can achieve. So I actually think it's the elected person's responsibility for promoting this election, because they have the resources, they have the prominence, and the fact that the media will talk to them. You know, they actually have the opportunity to really help here. I don't think that's happened a lot throughout the country. Some PCCs are...
Do you think Tony Hogg hasn't?
I think...
I thought Tony Hogg had done quite a good job at trying to promote it.
I think there's lots more that could have been done. So let me just talk about then what I
have to say. I don't think he did, because otherwise people would be far more aware of it now. They simply aren't aware of it. He has failed, and that's probably his biggest failure. And it could be because he's been too distracted with all the cuts and everything else. But he's certainly... I'm not saying the system has failed over the last 3.5 years to make people aware of this. When I have spoken to people in meetings... Sorry.
It's all right, Gareth.
When I have spoken to people in meetings... Actually, if you can spend half an hour talking it through, people get it.
Yeah.
They realise this is not a new waste of money. They realise it actually has superseded the old system of police authority, which was pretty powerless and very expensive. And they start thinking, actually, yes, it might be good to know who my PCC is and actually to choose the right one for me.
So going back to my answer. So the turnout, as everyone has said, will be higher in Plymouth and Exeter because there's local elections. Let's not kid ourselves here, though. Local election turnout's only 30%, and in some wards, 25%. You know, what the main issue is for me is it doesn't matter how low the turnout is, you are elected and you've got a job to do once you're elected. And as Richard has said, actually, we will all represent the community as a whole. We are not here to represent a party view. We are here to represent the community. When you're elected, you are responsible for everybody there. But the things that I've been doing, as the other candidates have, is going around all the towns and villages and trying to get to as far reach as we can in Devon and Cornwall to actually promote it physically, face to face, and talking to people. And as Gareth said, when you start doing that, they really do understand it. So we've exhausted, by the way, just so you know, we're on the last hustings here. We are really, really exhausted. So leafleting is absolutely key, because if they only receive your leaflet, they're more likely to vote for you because you bothered. So, you know, hopefully we've done all different patches, and then at least everyone will be out to vote.
At least we'll all get a vote.
But yeah, but the other area as well is online.
I haven't
actually
seen your leaflet yet from anyone.
I'd love to meet someone who had something from all of us. That would be really exciting. I don't think that's happening.
I haven't had anything from any of you.
Where'd
you live?
We're still delivering, by the way.
I live somewhere in North Devon.
But I've been actively promoting it online as well. So I'm on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. I've been doing all of those things.
This just in, I have now had a leaflet from Jonathan Smith, the UKIP candidate. Policing without politics. That's the headline.
So all we can do is our best as candidates to try and... But whoever is elected as the next PCC, their main job is to make sure that the public understand what that role is about and what it's it's achieving as it's doing.
Okay, we do need to move on. We're going to move on to Gareth's questions for the other candidates now. So, Gareth, you actually chose to ask different questions for each of the candidates. Can we start with your question to Alison, please?
Sure, okay, Alison. Do you believe, as Theresa May has stated recently, that falling crime statistics have justified the government's huge reductions in funding for policing?
Do you know, this is a really interesting one, right? So
that sounds like a politician's answer already.
No, it's a really good question, because we would all agree that falling crime, it doesn't feel like a reality. But this is why we've been going out when we're doing any hustings or talking to any members of the public. We're saying you must report it, right? As frustrating as 101 is to hang on to, please be persistent. You must report rural crime. People have given up in the rural areas, and we're saying please report it, because do you know what? If you report it, it gets logged. What then gets seen is a trend. What then happens is resources are put to it. So the issue for me is actually the fact that people are reducing reporting, and we've met many people, businesses particularly, have given up. And so I think the issue for me is we need to increase reporting, because I actually, it's true, you will only get resource if it's fact. The fact is you must report. So for me, we don't feel it's getting lower, but the reality is we must get people reporting, because that is going to make the difference.
The problem is Alison hasn't actually answered the question. The question is, does she believe that falling crime statistics have justified the government's huge reductions?
I do believe it, because it happens in Devon and Cornwall Police Force. When they look at their logs and they look at how they're going to resource things, they look at the evidence, they look at the crime stats. Mm. If people aren't, and that's how policing now actually delivered.
It's not just about stats and numbers. Now, you've talked about reporting, which is a fair point. Reporting is very, very poor in many areas. But the really important part of these statistics is you can't compare crime with crime just as a number. Some crimes bring out so much more harm, so much more long-term harm for the individuals. It's not like counting sweets. Mm. Some of these sweets are very much more sour than others. Domestic abuse has vastly long-term effects on people. So does child sexual exploitation. It's not a number thing. The really dangerous crimes are increasing. The really harmful crimes are increasing. Mm. Some of the less harmful ones are fading away.
Mm. Jonathan Smith, you just wanted to chip in.
The issue I have with the crime figures, as we're using them now, is reported and recorded crime. And being a Mid Devon District Councillor, I know that my constituents are not reporting crime. Mm. They know crime's going up, but they're not reporting it. And they're not reporting it because, A, they can't contact the police. And when they contact the police, they're not interested, or they won't want to record it as a particular crime. So that then gives a false crime figure. The police and the government are saying crime's falling. The public know it's not falling, it's going up. They manage to cut the budget as a result of crime is falling when it isn't. And then you have a negative cycle where you have less police officers, crime goes up, they're saying crime's going down because even fewer police officers report it to. So that's a crime performance target that has to be removed.
You can't just look at the figures to make the decisions. That's what I think we're always going to say.
Can we move on to your next question, sure. Gareth?
Well, let's give Richard one. Richard, if you were to achieve your campaign pledge to abolish the post of PCC, what would you put in its place and how would that be better?
Can I just slightly interject here? Because you won't have the power to abolish your own post if you're elected, will you?
I wish. No, my campaign to abolish it is to campaign to abolish it. And I will work with other PCCs to put the case that it needs to be got rid of.
But you must have a vision, though.
Oh, yeah, I do. I have a very clear vision. It needs to go back to something like the old police authority, but with the powers that have now been vested with the Police and Crime Commissioner. You have a panel made up largely of councillors, maybe directly elected or elected via their council, but onto that you add representation from the mental health services, from the probation service and others. So you have expertise on the panel and you have the elected element. So it's both democratic and expert. And then you allocate responsibilities within those for different areas. What you end up with is a body which is well embedded in the community, which enables them to have feedback, but also has the power to hold and to supervise different elements of the police force. So you would have one board member who would be responsible for covering one assistant chief constable, and one would cover the chief constable, which would be the chair.
I think what Richard's outlined there is what I brought up weeks ago, which is the police and community cooperative.
Indeed, and I think basically what you've said is all of that stuff can basically be done within the current framework, but what you have, if you give up the PCC, is that single person that the public are aware of that has the power and the focus to take charge of things when things go wrong.
Yes, but what you have in having a single person is you're going down the power of the cult of the personality. But you also have particular problems. When it comes to dismissing the chief constable, and it has happened, when the mayor of London dismissed the chief constable in London, it was widely seen as a political move and much criticised. If you had a former police officer who was a chief constable and he didn't dismiss the chief constable, then you know they'll say, oh well, it's all boys working together. You can't just have a single person.
But the reality
if you invest it within a broader panel, it's democratic, and you avoid.
My concern here, I mean, the points you make are fair enough, but I do feel that once you get into this sort of committee level thing, that committee,
people are led by
committees
person.
Do not take these kind of very strong actions when they just all agree.
But if you look, and we just agreed earlier how well the select committee system works in Parliament, those committees hold ministers to account very robustly, and they make recommendations to the government to change policy, which the ministers very often have to listen to. If it can work as well as the select committees do, it will work very well indeed.
Okay, could we move on to your final question, your question for Jonathan Smith of UKIP.
Jonathan, in your official election address, you posed the question, do we really want a Europol-governed political police service? What did you mean by that?
Let me just read this out to you. This, you'll recognise, is the job description of the Police and Crime Commissioner. Secure an efficient and effective police for their area. Appoint a chief constable. Hold them to account for in the force, etc. Dismiss them. Set the plan and crime objectives in their area through a police and crime plan. Set the force budget and determine the precept. Contribute to national and international policing capabilities determined by the Home Secretary. Bring together community safety and criminal justice partners and ensure that local priorities are joined up. That's the job description we'll be taking on.
Okay.
But that job description wasn't lifted from gov.uk or COPAC or the Police and Crime Commissioner website. That job description was lifted from the European website, and it's a job description of the French mayor.
So now, what?
Our police force has already been set up for Europol intervention. We've already got the structure the same. We've got French Mayor, Police and Crime Commissioner. We've got Mutual Aid, CRS. We've got Gendarmerie and Operational Police Officers. We've got PCSOs and Local Police Municipal. So we've got to consider what happens if that does occur. The Police and Crime Commission won't be accountable to the Home Secretary. The Police and Crime Commission will be accountable to the European Commission.
I don't wear it, Jonathan, because you're talking about how you would do the role, as we've all agreed to do it, in accordance with that job description. And how does that make it a Europol-governed political police service? We're all promising to be apolitical once we're in post.
Yes, but what I'm saying is it's actually lined up for as the French mayor. So if they enforce it rigorously, then it will be the same system as in France. Now, France doesn't have habeas corpus. France has corpus juris.
I won't be relating to any of this stuff when I'm in post as PCC.
We do have habeas corpus, and that's not going to be taken away.
Okay. I think we are running a bit out of time now. We're going to go for, I think, about another 8 minutes. So, Richard, can we have your question for the other candidates, please?
Yes. You wanted a slightly different question. I think it is slightly different to the others. Is it ever justifiable to knowingly allow the law to be broken?
Sounds like we've become an episode of The Moral Maze momentarily. Can we start with Jonathan Smith, UKIP?
Yes. It's called... what is it? It's something of necessity. It's coercion of necessity, where you have to break a law to enforce a more serious law. It's quite acceptable if you're being attacked. This is a stated case in law. If you're being attacked, if you're going to get a good hiding, you can actually drive someone at someone with a car. That's a stated case. There is a specific defence in law. There's a set of guidelines that says you can argue that you can break a law. For example, police officers, when they're carrying out a pursuit, police officers heading to emergency incident, they can break knowingly a double white line system, because to actually comply with that double white line system would frustrate the purpose which that vehicle was being used. So yes, you can justify breaking laws for those reasons.
I was looking more at the community rather than just police officers.
That's not just police officers. That's not just police officers. As I said to you before, if you've got a situation where you perhaps have had slightly too much to drink and you come across somebody who is dying in the road, you have a defence or you have a mitigation to take that person to hospital, knowing that you have drunk too much alcohol.
It's a mitigation, isn't it?
It's a mitigation, yes.
Okay. Alison Hernandez.
Can you just repeat the question, Richard? Sorry, what was it?
It was, is it ever justifiable to knowingly allow someone to break the law?
Oh, I see. Well, the bit for me is, and this is what Devon and Cornwall Police are doing at the moment, they've got a very clear mission statement, which is about threat, risk and harm, level of threat, risk and harm. And they are having to prioritise the response to things around how much threat is there that's happened, how much risk is there to the individual, how much harm is happening and all of that. So I think discretion of police officers is very important. And I do think that that is something that you can do if they think that it's not in the public interest to actually carry on and make this an absolute big thing when they can see that there's actually something better that they could be using with their time. I do think that using threat, risk and harm is a really good way of deciding how much effort to put in it and whether it's in the public interest to do so.
Okay, Gareth, Derek?
Going last, I think I have to say that we have had two pretty good answers here. One is based on sort of the legal side of it, and the other one is this concept of threat, risk and harm. Actually, yes, I agree. There are times when it must be acceptable to allow people to knowingly break laws where there are bigger issues that are of a higher priority that need to be dealt with. That's the end of it, really.
Richard, do you think your question's been answered?
On a technical level, yes, but you have the case, particularly at the moment, where we have police not arriving, not investigating. The police are currently allowing the law to be broken and not investigating. What would the candidates do about that?
Talking here about zero tolerance type policies, aren't we? Mm. That we're talking about. And, you know, zero tolerance policies have been mentioned by some of the candidates this election, yeah. And you know, they can be very effective to be used at certain times. But I don't think they are the answer to our problems because they are hugely demanding resources, and you end up in a state whereby you could have a very, very intolerant society.
Yeah, but isn't that kind of chiming with the whole kind of broken windows thing if they did in New York, where it was like low level crime was tackled, and that then helped to stop the bigger level crime?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, that's one of the reasons why PCSOs are such a success, because they actually prevent the need for people to be breaking laws and getting away with it, actually, because they do focus on those lower level things that affect the community. And if you focus your resource on actually tackling that, the bigger crimes don't happen in those areas. I mean, you still have the organised stuff, you do still have offenders out there, but if you actually tackle those low level stuff that actually doesn't get to the point of breaking laws, it's just a nuisance, it's just an annoyance, that makes a big difference to a community.
What you mentioned there, Broken Windows campaign, it was William Bratton who was the commissioner for Rudy Giuliano in New York. And it was zero tolerance. If you dropped a bit of paper on the floor, you were hammered, etc. But the police in New York and American police have far better resources than us. They're better equipped. They have the prisons, they have the justice system, the prison system. We don't have that here. And we don't police the way they police. We police by consent. Mm. Now, a police officer has absolute discretion to discharge the rules of the law how he sees fit. He's a custodian of the law. He's integrally linked to the law. And he discharges it to his best ability the way he sees fit. If we go down the line of hammering everybody for breaking every law, we will lose that connectivity, we will lose touch, and we will lose the right to police by consent.
That's a really good
Absolutely
point.
Right.
Yeah.
And in this force, we cannot police without the consent of our... They invite us into their community to uphold law and order. If they don't let us police by consent, we won't be able to police.
OK.
But there's lines and boundaries, and I think there's a lot of the public out there would say that there's a number of instances where the law is not being upheld and it should be.
And yes, there are circumstances in Devon and Cornwall that where crime isn't being investigated and crime isn't being recorded. I totally agree with that. Commercial theft, commercial shoplifting isn't being investigated.
That's a really big one.
And if we don't investigate it, it goes the other way. It takes us to career criminals. It allows them to have a career choice
Let's
as a criminal.
We all know that the Devon and Cornwall Police have got a concept of demand management.
Mm. All right.
They have a reason for that.
But we need to move on to the final question, which I know you're all going to love. I've been looking forward to asking you this one. So we'll start with Jonathan Smith of UKIP.
Got to go now.
When Paddy Ashdown stood in Yeovil, when election day came round, he never voted for himself. He always picked one of his opponents who he thought would make the best MP, other than himself, and voted for them. So if you had to vote for one of your opponents and were not allowed to vote for yourself, and you have to answer the question,
this is a good one.
Which one would you vote for and why? And bear in mind that actually on the ballot paper there is a second choice. So actually you could put this into practice, vote for yourself number one and this other person number two. Jonathan Smith.
That's all. Horrible question.
You've got to be quick, we've got a minute left.
All right, based on the fact that he agrees that the Office of the Police and Crime Commissioner isn't fit for purpose and needs reorganising, it would have to be
William Younger Ross, the Liberal Democrat.
Richard Younger Ross.
I said, I didn't know his name. Maybe you spoiled that paper.
William Youngers was a brewing chain.
Okay,
I recognise it. I'm from UKIP.
So UKIP backs Lib Dem shocker. Okay, that's the headline. So Richard Younger Ross, who would you vote for and why?
I think if you look at it, and I just look at the people I've met during this, not friendships, but the camaraderie we've had and listening to them, I'd actually probably vote for Gareth because I've been very impressed with his experience and background. And I think that if I was not to be selected, then I think he would be very good in the post.
OK, Gareth.
Well, I'm afraid I wouldn't vote for the Conservative candidate, much as I've enjoyed my experience.
I know no one's going to say me.
I actually wouldn't vote for a former member of the police force, purely because I think that's something just not quite right about that, fundamentally.
OK, we've got 20 seconds, so I need your answer.
I won't vote for people that want to abolish the post, and therefore I'm left with my good friend William Morris, the independent.
Alison Hernandez, 10 seconds.
I would almost change my mind in light of what Gareth has said, but actually I would vote for Gareth.
OK. Thank you very much. Thank you very much to all the candidates. Jonathan Smith, UKIP, Richard Younger, Ross Lib Dem, Alison Hernandez, Conservative, and Gareth Derrick, Labour.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Enjoyed that.
Thank you.
Mark Thompson on Tilt at the Mill.
Looking at current affairs and culture from a different angle.